Let's get started. I think today's lecture should be quite a bit of fun. We're going to kind of cover a spectrum of things which appeals to a variety of different students of quantum physics. We're going to look at very kind of deep conceptual issues. We're going to look at some highly non-trivial mathematics when we talk about infinite dimensional Hilbert space. The deep conceptual issues are pertaining to measurement and the meaning of measurement in quantum mechanics. And then we'll also, there was one other thing, but we'll leave it at that for now. That should be enough. Okay. So we'll follow up on this discussion of the state update rule. In other words, how do we describe a quantum system after measurement? So we imagine that we have a measurement device which takes as input some state rho and as output some state rho prime. And so here we have the setting which kind of chooses the measurement. And then this is a measurement box, but what's distinctive about this measurement box is that it has the output state. So we call this, sometimes we call this a quantum instrument. This is not universally adopted terminology, but I like it. So basically it means measurement with update, measurement as a transformation. Okay, and then in addition to the settings, we also have the readout. And so this is the pointer, which is the readout, which is classical output. So you can think of the setting as classical input. And you could think of the pointer readout as the classical output. And then here, of course, you have the quantum input, and we have the quantum output. Where here quantum doesn't necessarily mean that it's non-classical, but it has the potential to be non-classical. And then as usual, we're going to assume that for the moment we're just dealing with ideal quantum mechanics, so everything is a pure state, and the output actually may or may not be a pure state depending on the scenario we're describing. Rho prime may or may not be a pure state. Okay, so then we have to describe this, the mathematical rules. First, let's establish a notation. So we'll call some abstract linear operator A is going to be the measurement. We know it has to be a Hermitian operator, a self-adjoint operator. So we give it some spectral decomposition where the AMs are real numbers and the pi m's are projectors. So this means that they satisfy the following relationship. And it means that they're self-adjoint, which follows from assuming A is self-adjoint. Okay, so that's the structure. That's our setting is going to specify what the AMs are and what the PIMs are. And the AMs are associated with as labels of the pointer output. So then we know from the Born rule, which is postulate 2, we know that the probability of outcome M is equal to the trace of the projector pi M against the input state. So then we have that in the special case, that AM is non-degenerate, then pi M is equal to psi M, which is a rank 1 projector. And in case of a rank 1 projector, we have the probability of M is equal to the trace of psi m rho. We'll substitute for rho psi, and then this is just equal to psi magnitude squared. Okay, so now we want to talk about the mathematical rules for update. So for update, we have conditional on outcome AM being observed. Which just means known. Then we have Luder's rule, which states that the update process rho goes to rho prime, which is equal to the projector onto M of rho, projector onto M. And then we divide that by the trace of pi M rho. Okay, so we're projecting the output state onto the subspace associated with the projector pi m. And then we're renormalizing the state. We're dividing by the probability of that output from the Born rule. Any questions about that? This in a box because it's a key result. And then let's make some remarks. Remark: in the special case, that pi m is rank 1. Actually, shouldn't call it psi m here. I should call it am. Let me fix this because I've already given. Oh no, I haven't done that. All right. Yeah, it's a little bit confusing. I mean, I can leave it as psi m, I guess. All that refers to. So what that means is that a psi m is equal to am. Psi M. An alternate notation would be to designate these eigenvectors with the same labels as the eigenvalue. That's a common alternate notation. So when we use the notation psi m, we're really thinking of this as a component of the input state. So let me just say, recall that we can always expand any state with respect to an orthonormal basis. So we'd imagine psi is equal to a sum over m cm psi m, or we could write this as psi is equal to a sum over m cm am, where of course cm is equal to psi m psi or am psi. Sorry, this might be slightly confusing because now I'm carrying both notations and they mean the same thing. So if that's confusing, don't let it be confusing. I'm just using two different symbols to mean the same thing. And which symbol you use really depends on the context. You can think of this as the components of psi with respect to the basis of A, or you can write it directly in terms of the eigenstates of A. Either way, it's the index m that really matters. Okay? So in the special case that the projector is rank one, at some point I'll stop carrying both notations. So these are equivalent notationally. In that special case, then the update rule is that rho goes to rho prime, which is equal to am. So in this case, we say that the eigenstate. So first of all, this was discovered by von Neumann. So this is attributed to von Neumann sometime in the 1930s. Von Neumann wrote essentially the first consistent mathematical treatment of quantum theory in the 1930s. I think it was 35. It might have been that he wrote it in German in the early 30s and was translated to English in the 1935. But let me just discovered this rule. And then later on, Luders said, well, actually, we can have non-rank one measurements. So some years later, and I don't recall the date of Luders' result. I don't know if I have it in my notes. But some years later, Luders discovered that there was an important situation that von Neumann hadn't considered, which is this situation of having higher rank measurements. This situation. And so he generalized von Neumann's update rule to this. And so sometimes now, instead of Luders' rule, it's called the Luders von Neumann rule, because they both kind of had a role in developing it. And let me just remark that, let me move the whiteboard first. That didn't work. The usual textbook statement is the von Neumann rule. Which not only is it not sufficiently general, but it's also usually stated in a false way. So the usual textbook statement says that after measurement, the system is left in an eigenstate, or in the eigenstate of the observable associated with the observed outcome. Okay, so this is a typical statement you'll see, and first of all, it's not completely general, but more importantly, there are important types of measurements where this isn't true. Okay, this is not always true. It depends on the type of measurement. It depends on how the measurement was performed. Okay, so as an example, consider measuring the polarization or the energy or momentum of a photon via a calorimeter or a photodetector. One of the most canonical cases of measurement you can imagine. What happens? The photon gets absorbed in the process of that measurement procedure. So the photon doesn't even exist anymore. It's been turned into the kinetic energy of an electron. Okay, so with a photodetector, you have some incoming photon, H nu. And then you have a photodetector which has these flanges. And then you have some kind of voltage difference across the device. And then when the photon comes in, it hits one of these flanges and it ejects an electron via the, what's that called? This is the standard thing that Einstein used to discover the quantization of photoelectric effect. Thank you. That's what he got the Nobel Prize for. And then this electron feels the potential difference, and so it gets accelerated to the next flange, and then you get this cascade effect of a whole bunch more electrons, and then they hit this flange, and so on. And then eventually you put this into some circuit, and you can measure the current in the circuit. Maybe I should put this to ground. Okay, I'm drawing the circuit off the top of my head. I can't promise it's right, but the point is you get some current in a circuit, and then you can, of course, measure this. And then you have an ammeter, and you see some current, and that current tells you something about the energy of the photon. The photon's gone. I've measured its energy, I've measured its momentum, and this photon is certainly not left in an eigenstate of the outcome I observe. So here's my pointer. I built this device, so I know how the current relates to the energy. This is a canonical measurement, but this statement does not apply. Okay, so it's clear that this statement is only going to apply if we do the measurement in a particular way. So last class, I promised you I would derive the update rule. And so now I'll show you how you do that. You have to specify what kind of measurement are you doing. And based on the design of that measurement, then you can deduce that the Luders rule has to follow from just the postulates of quantum mechanics. I wish I wrote this correctly. So, I mean, I guess you get a current. Put it through a resistor. I guess the ammeter is somehow in the loop normally. And then maybe you don't want a voltage difference. Maybe you don't want a voltage source, because a voltage source here, that induces a current. Maybe this goes to ground or something. Maybe that's ground too. And then this is some positive voltage relative to ground. Does that look reasonable? Any circuit experts? Okay, let's hope that works. Anyways, you get the gist of it. The point is to illustrate a principle, not to get into Kirchhoff's laws. Okay. I should pay attention to my notes. So before I derive this, I first wanted to explain to you the practical consequences of having non-rank one measurements. Okay, so first, let's look at non-rank one measurements, non-rank one projectors, and understand the practical significance of that. So as an example, let's consider a three-dimensional Hilbert space. And then let's define our measurement to be A equals A1 phi 1. I should not call it phi here. I should call it, let's call it A1 plus A perp . Okay, so the eigenvalue A perp is associated with a two-dimensional subspace. This is a two-dimension, this projects onto a two-dimensional subspace. Of H. And then let's assume the input state psi is equal to some superposition of . So this isn't an assumption, this is just, I'm writing down any quantum state can be written in this way. I'm assuming it's pure. So it's an ideal state. Then we can look at, suppose outcome A perp is obtained via the pointer. Then our input state rho, which is equal to the projector onto psi. And we don't have to use the density operator picture for this. We could have done this just with vectors. Is going to go to some rho prime, and that's going to be the projector. Let me call it pi perp. Rho pi perp divided by the trace of pi perp rho. Okay, so that's Luder's rule, and then let's make sure we just define pi perp here in the obvious way. It's going to be A2 plus A3, A3. So this is a definition. I'll put little dots there. So then, under outcome A perp, we get rho prime is equal to C2 squared A2 plus C3 squared A3 plus the cross terms. So the message here mathematically is that the coherence, so this is a coherent superposition of states A1, A2, and A3. And these are complex numbers, these are complex coefficients. And the relative phase between C1 and C2 and C2 and C3 is the relative phase between these states, which contains interesting and important information about the quantum system. The point being that under a rank 2 measurement, we're going to preserve the coherence of the input state across this subspace, but we'll lose this component. So that means we have the cross terms. We have C2, C3 bar. Plus C2 bar C3. So these are coherence terms. These are the coherence in the in this subspace is preserved. Okay, so contrast this with, we have without post-selection. Oh, did I refer to this as post-selection? I meant to write that down. So when we say conditional on the outcome, we're post-selecting on the outcome. So, i.e., without conditioning on the observation of the outcome, of the classical output, which is the pointer position, then we had Luder's rule without conditioning was rho goes to rho prime equal to a sum over m, probability of m divided by the trace of pi m rho. Oh, did I not? I also made a mistake here. Anybody see what mistake I made here? Sorry? Did I make a mistake in the formula? No, it's up there. So what part of this formula did I not use here? I can't hear you guys.
Normalization.
Thank you. I forgot normalization. So here we need to add normalization. So let's call this rho tilde. And then rho prime is equal to rho tilde prime divided by the trace of pi m rho, which is pi m in this case is pi perp, which I think I defined it as pi perp here. So what's that going to be? It's going to be rho tilde prime as written here plus C2 squared plus this C3 squared. Okay, so we divide by the probability of this outcome, which doesn't include the coherence terms. It's just the absolute value of the components of the state in that subspace. And this gives us a normalized state. So now we're describing future measurements on this state. We'll have probabilities that add to 1. That's what that means. So it's a bookkeeping. It's just a bookkeeping effect. And often, in fact, you can just drop this and not worry about it. And then once you're at the end of your calculation, you can just normalize appropriately. OK, so here we have this normalization factor. But now we're weighting each of the output states by this probability of m, which is, of course, the Born rule just says that the probability of m is equal to the trace of pi m rho. So here we're multiplying by the same thing, multiplying and dividing by the same thing. So this is just equal to a sum over m pi m rho pi m. So now if we perform this measurement, if we perform this measurement again, But now we don't see the pointer pointing to a perp because the detector output failed, or we didn't look, or our friend didn't tell us. So maybe our friend saw the output and says, now describe the state, but I'm not telling you what output I got, what the classical output was. Then you have rho tilde prime is going to be equal to C1 squared phi 1. Oh, I keep calling it phi 1. So that's what's in the notes. It's A1. A1 plus, let me give this a subscript. Non-post-selected, let's call it NPS. Rho prime NPS is equal to this component plus rho tilde prime as described by the with post-selection case. So this rho tilde prime. Write it this way. So in other words, we now recover a state which has support on all three components of the operator, of the measurement. The coherence is preserved in the rank 2 subspace, and the coherence between the rank 1 measurement and the rank 2 measurement is lost. So there's no terms of the form C1, C2 bar, or C1, C3 bar. Those terms are killed off because of the fact that those are distinct outcomes. So because the measurement device can, in principle, distinguish these things, I've killed the coherence between those two subspaces. OK, how are you guys doing with that? Is that all pretty straightforward or new? Yes?
I'm a little bit confused. I don't know about what.
OK, so if you can maybe ask a more pointed question, that might help.
I guess, can you just repeat the last part with the stuff on the right?
This last piece talking about the non-post-selected case?
Maybe if I just say it, I can see if I'm getting it right.
Sure. That's a good idea.
If you have this thing and, I already sound like I'm doing a bad job. It takes a measurement, and then you update the probability of seeing certain states because of that measurement, some of which can be related to each other, and that's why you get two of them whenever you're updating it, right? And then if we measure it again, but maybe the machine screws up and doesn't record the reading, or whatever way you want to say it.
Or if you're unfamiliar with it for any reason.
Yes. So then we just have, we bring in the old probability from that we had before, basically. Like the other possible state that was ruled out if we had seen the measurement is now brought in again. Is that what you're saying?
The word state, you have to be careful. I would say the component of the state. Yeah, I would just replace what you said with component of the state. So this component of the state is brought back because it could have, here's why you get this term. Because you didn't see the detector, you didn't see the ammeter result. So it's possible that the outcome of the measurement was A1. So when you're describing the system after measurement, and it's possible that the outcome was A1, then your description of the output system has to include the possibility that future measurements will tell you that the system is in the state A1, or has a component, a non-zero probability of that component.
Why isn't it just the same as the input then?
That's a good question, because that's what you'd expect classically.
Yeah.
But quantum mechanically, and that's a great question, but that's something which I'm going to punt on, because we will see that in depth in about a lecture or two. We'll go to an exact example of why you lose coherence by doing a quantum mechanical analysis of the measurement device. Okay, so that's coming up. So I'll ask you to be patient, and then you'll see why that term gets killed off. Yeah?
This rho tilde prime NPS, it's already normalized, right? So your tilde convention might not.
So it's unnecessary. But I think it might be, well, let's be careful, actually. I'm glad you asked that, because I have to be careful now, because rho tilde is unnormalized. And then we've added this in, and that's enough to renormalize it, I think. Yeah. Because, yeah, if you take the trace of this, it's going to have probability c2 squared plus c3 squared plus c1 squared. Yeah, so now this is normalized. So this is actually automatically normalized. So we don't need the tilde convention. We don't need the tilde convention here, but we still need to keep it here. So the way you read this formula is, and this might help with the person who asked the last question, the way you read this formula is that this right here is a normalized quantum state associated with output m, where m can equal 1 or m can equal perp. And this is the probability of getting that output state. So we're adding up, we're doing a classical sum over the different quantum states we could have obtained based on the different classical outputs weighted by the Born rule probability of each of those cases. What about the rest of you? Is this you're comfortable? Questions?
And when you say the coherence in the subspace is preserved,
yeah.
How do you know that and how do you measure the coherence of subspaces?
That's a great question. Wondering if I want to go into a detailed example. Let me give you an overview of the answer, and if you want more detail, I can give an explicit example. The way you would do it is you would do a subsequent measurement. So actually here, let me draw a picture. Actually, that's a great question because it's actually a good segue to my next point. So the point is, how do we know this is correct? Okay, so what we do is we chain together multiple measurements in sequence, in series. So you would have your first measurement box, and you choose a setting, and this setting is measuring observable A. Okay, it's set to measure A as opposed to B or C. A really good paradigm to have in your mind for this is measuring spin components. So you think about measuring the spin component SZ or SX or SY. Of course, in the case of a rank 3 measurement, that's not going to work. We have to think about angular momentum L equals 1 in that case. And then here's our pointer. And in this case, we just really have two outcomes. We have the outcome A1 and A perp. And then we have something invisible comes into this device, something invisible comes out. We call this rho. We call this rho prime. And now what we do is we take another device designed in exactly the same way. So this is the same design. So this is the Luders 3000. So we know that the setting means the same thing, the pointers mean the same thing, and here we have A1, A perp, and we have these two outcomes. And then we need a symbol to represent the invisible thing that comes out of the right-hand side of the second device, and we'll use a double prime for that notation. So the first thing you want to check is repeatability. So what this means, let's call this one measurement number 1, and this one measurement number 2. If 1 gives outcome A1, or let's call it A perp, then 2 must also give outcome A1 or A perp, right? Because note that the probability of output A perp given output A1 on the first measurement is equal to the trace of A perp on rho prime, where rho prime is equal to A1. And of course, A perp and A1 are orthogonal. So given the orthogonality, it must be that if you get some outcome here, you have to get the same outcome here, or you're not doing the measurement you thought you were doing. So that's just checking you're in the right subspace. But now you're asking, how do I know that the particular coherent superposition between A2 and A3 is preserved? And that's a great question, because that's a very practical experimental question. If you're building a device like this, you want to be able to check that this device isn't doing, is not doing. In other words, now next is, how do we check that A equals A1 pi 1 plus A perp pi perp versus A equal to A1 pi 1 plus A2, A2 plus A3, A3. So notice, let's call this A tilde. Okay, so how do we know that the device is doing this measurement and not this measurement? So first, answer this question for me. What would the output state be? Suppose that my device is actually doing this measurement. And then what it does is then the meter just can't resolve A2 and A3, because really A2 and A3 are two lines so close to each other that when I look at the meter with my lousy eyesight, I can't tell if it's A2 or A3. So I just call that A perp. And this is the measurement that's actually being performed, and I get the output A perp. So suppose that's the case. I hope it's clear what the question is. Suppose that this is what my device is measuring. First of all, suppose I don't look at the output. What would the output state be for without post-selection under this measurement?
Can you repeat the question again?
Okay, I'm glad I asked this question, because, okay, what is the output state? I'll write it down. What is rho prime under measurement A tilde? Sorry. Without post-selection. So without conditioning. No.
Is a classical mix?
It will not be the initial state.
A classical mix of the three states?
It'll be a classical mixture of the three states. Rho prime will be C1 squared A1 plus C2 squared A2 plus C3 squared A3. So this destroys the coherence between all three eigenvectors of the observable. This is very important. Okay, so let me show you how this follows from Luder's rule, because this is an important point, and I see that it's worth elaborating. So here's the proof. Okay, so the proof is this. Luder's rule says rho goes to rho prime which is equal to a sum over M, probability of M, pi M rho, pi M over the trace of, well, I'll just over probability of M. Okay, so for A tilde, we have the operator is A1 pi 1 plus A2 pi 2 plus A3 pi 3. So this is a non-degenerate measurement. Here's where everything you learned about degeneracy versus non-degeneracy in undergrad is you're seeing the full power of this under the update rule. So this is a fully non-degenerate measurement. A without the tilde was partially non-degenerate. A1 was non-degenerate, but A2 and A3 were degenerate, right? So this is now fully non-degenerate because each of the eigenvalues corresponds to a rank 1 projector. So we have pi j is equal to aj, aj for every j in 1, 2, 3. Okay? That's what I mean. Actually, this implies that. So, okay, based on the example, it was obvious from here because I'm assuming a three-dimensional system, but just to be explicitly clear, we're assuming each of these projectors is rank 1, so we have a fully non-degenerate measurement. So Luder's rule tells us this is the rule for calculating rho prime. So now we do, well, then rho prime is going to be equal to a sum over m. And what's each of these probabilities? Well, it's just going to be cm squared. Because we're, again, using the input state from our initial problem. So we're still using that input state right there. So we're assuming here rho is equal to psi, and psi is equal to sum over j, cj, aj. Here, j and m are both dummy indices. So now this is the probability of m. And then we put the bracket term is going to be aj, aj, rho, aj, aj. And this is going to be divided by cm squared. I should probably use the same index in this equation. Sorry about that. There, that makes more sense. And now these terms, these obviously cancel. So now we have a sum over m. So now let me just write out the sum. We have a1, a1 rho, a1, a1 plus a2, a2 rho, a2, a2 plus a3, a3 rho, a3, a3. Okay, and what's rho? Rho is this object. So then what we get is, when we take the, this is the expectation value of rho in the state A2. So the point is, we recall that, of course, because this is an orthonormal basis, we have AM, AM prime is equal to delta M, M prime. So the only term of rho that's going to survive for the first term is going to be the C1 component. So then this is equal to C1 squared A1 A1 plus C2 squared A2 A2 plus C3 squared A3 A3. Full stop. And then the point here is that there are no cross terms. No cross terms. Because the measurement has destroyed all coherences. The coherences are the relative phases. The relative phases, coherences between the eigenstates of A. This is A tilde, right? Between the eigenstates of A tilde. Okay, so that, now you see a big difference between A tilde and A. So without post-selection, under A, we preserved coherences both in the post-selected case and in the non-post-selected case. Up here we have the coherences between A2 and A3 are preserved. Because of the degeneracy, and here without any degeneracies, none of the coherences are preserved. So that's the claim. Any questions about that? Yes?
Can you actually measure if the coherence is there or not?
Thank you, and that's exactly the question this person asked. Sir, do you mind? I mean, maybe I should learn your names.
Neve.
I'm sorry?
Neve.
Okay, and?
I'm Jessica.
So that's exactly the question Neve asked. Now, and that's a great question. The question is, how do we actually operationally verify that this rule is correct? All right, so I guess I have to start erasing. Okay, I'll give you a moment to digest that. Okay, let's do this. The idea is you have to measure a non-commuting observable in the H-perp subspace. So that's the answer. So let me spell that out. You measure a non-commuting observable in the H-perp subspace. So the H-perp, so H is equal to H1 plus H-perp. How many of you are familiar with this direct sum notation? Excellent. For those of you not familiar with it, there's a simple example. In R3, which is Cartesian, so a Cartesian vector space. So here you have a vector space V equal to R3. Which is going to be, I don't know what notation to use here, but you're going to have a unit vector EX, a unit vector EY, and a unit vector EZ. And then what I can do is I can say what I can do is I can say that the plane XY is a two-dimensional subspace of, let me call it V3, which is equal to, we'll call it VXY. Let me change how I write this. We'll call it VXY of V3. So the two-dimensional subspace is this plane in the three-dimensional space. And then you would just write the vector space V3 is equal to VZ plus VXY. Okay, so what we're doing is we're just adding to the vector space in an orthogonal direction. Okay, so we're just adding now a Z component to our description by appending VZ. Okay, so this is a plus sign. So here the notation plus means is basically adding orthogonal subspaces. Okay, does that help? So when we're talking about H perp is the subspace spanned by A2 and A3, and H1 is the subspace spanned by A1. So we're adding up those two subspaces, we're kind of pasting them together to create a bigger Hilbert space, which is now it's called the tensor sum. And there's really nothing magical happening. It's exactly what you do when you say, oh, I'm not interested in describing just the XY plane. I want to describe also the Z component of my system. I want to take a two-dimensional space through a three-dimensional space. I just do a tensor sum of the vector spaces, and I get my three-dimensional space. So here, H perp is this subspace associated with the degenerate observable in the case of A. And H perp is associated with the non-degenerate observable of over 2 and 3 in the case of A tilde. And then H1 is non-degenerate in both cases. So the point is, this is what we have to do to determine if we're measuring A or A tilde. So let me show you what that looks like operationally. So now we have a box . This is rho prime . So this is the Luders 3000 . I buy two of them from the store . Okay it's trademarked. Forget that. Okay, so this one I set to measure A, and this one I do a different setting. So this is some observable B. Okay, so what we want that B and A do not commute. And here I'm going to say something that I'm not 100% sure is right, that we specifically want them to not commute in the subspace. I mean, I haven't thought about it that way before. It might be that this is a little bit of a loose description. We want something more precise, which is that we really are concerned with, we're really concerned with the restriction of this observable to the perp subspace, and the restriction of this observable to the perp subspace, and whether or not they commute in that subspace. That's what we care about. The question is that a non-trivial constraint beyond this? I don't know. It could be that because the other subspace is rank one, all observables commute. So the only way they can not commute, now that's, okay, I have to think about that. So for now, this is probably fine, and I'll give you an example. So in particular, let B equal A1 plus let's call it P perp, and we want P perp and Pi perp do not commute. This is what I was getting at about restricting to the subspace. So recall, and then we have A is equal to A or A tilde, and that's the question we're asking. So this is a terrible notation. So let's call this O, and then let's say O is equal to A or A tilde, and we want B and A tilde. A tilde is the one that's the non-trivial one that preserves coherence, so we really want this to be true. So we want pi perp and P perp, so B is a different observable. In fact, it should have different coefficients. Let's call it B1 and B perp. Okay, so this is our spectral decomposition of B, and we construct B so that it doesn't commute with the projector onto the subspace, the degenerate subspace of A tilde. So how do you do that? Well, for example, I know how we do it. Let's recall that pi perp is equal to A2 plus A3. That was the definition from A tilde. And then what we're going to do is we're going to define linear combinations of A2 and A3. So we'll define B2 is equal to A2 plus e to the I theta A3, and then B3 is whatever vector is orthogonal to that, which is, so here I need a square root of 2. B3 is going to be equal to A2. Here, let me forget the theta. Let me just do it like this. A2 minus A3 over square root of 2. Okay, so now the point is B2 is no, whoops. Now the point is B2 and B3 are orthogonal. But B2 is not orthogonal to either A2 or A3, and likewise for B3. So if we construct an observable which has this linear combination of the components of the projector for A tilde, then we'll be able to detect whether or not the output state is in a coherent superposition. So now what we have to do is we say, okay, well now, in fact, let me furthermore specify, because I realize I did this in too much generality, we take P perp to be equal to B2, this is exactly what I had. Now let me think. I mean, right now I've defined B to be a rank 2 projector on P perp, and I think that was a mistake. I think I want B to be non-degenerate. So I want B to be of the form I want B to be of the form B2, B2, plus B3, B3. So B is some non-degenerate measurement in a slightly different basis. So B1 is equal to A1, but B2 and B3 are not equal to A2 and A3. For those of you who are wondering where I'm going, what I'm trying to do is I'm turning the rank 2 subspace into a spin half problem. And if you think about A2 and A3 as being spin up and spin down along Z, then this definition of B2 and B3 gives you spin up and spin down along X. Okay? And so then the point is that the point is now that if rho prime is equal to C1 squared A1 plus the coherent superposition, what I call it, rho tilde prime. And now we're going to condition on the output. So we're going to condition So we condition on the outcome A perp under measurement 1. So that means that our output state is either, that means we either have case 1 is that rho prime is equal to rho tilde prime. Rho tilde, did I erase that? And case two is that rho prime is equal to C2 squared A2 plus C3 squared A3, right? So in this case, we have the coherences. So we have in this case, we have rho prime perp plus the cross terms. So please pick up if I got the notation mixed up, because you have your notes in front of you. But I'm calling rho tilde the output state. So we don't know what rho prime is. That was the question. We don't know if rho prime is rho tilde prime, which has coherence between A2 and A3, or if it's rho tilde, rho prime untilded, which has just the populations with no cross terms. So this is no coherence. Okay, so how do we tell that? Now we're going to measure this observable B. And in particular, what we're interested in is the functional form of B in the subspace of interest, which is the subspace on which the output state has support, because we've conditioned on being in that subspace. We just don't know if we have a coherent or incoherent superposition in that subspace. So then we look at Born's rule. This better work. Okay, so then the probability of output B2 conditioned on rho perp prime versus the probability of output B2 conditioned on rho tilde perp. Okay, is this notation clear so far? Have I lost most of you? This is a little bit more of an involved answer than I thought it would be. But so here we go. So now we're going to calculate this. This is going to be the trace of B2 under rho perp prime. And this is going to be the trace of B2 under rho perp tilde prime. And I mean, okay, so can we just see right away that it's going to be different? So
square coefficients for...
Pardon me?
Square coefficients C2 and C3.
Thank you. This is how, what's the easiest? So, I mean, so the, now the point is clearly these are different states, so we just want to show that, we just want to show that the output is different. So let's just calculate what we get from this term, and then we'll show that these pieces give a non-trivial contribution. All right, that should be enough to show that you get different predictions. We can certainly make our life a lot simpler if we give ourselves the power to choose the coefficients of the input state. If we choose C2 and C3 to be 1 over square root of 2, then that makes our job easier. But let's just look at it. So under this simple case, we're going to have this is dead easy. Okay, good. So we're going to have C2 squared B2 A2 squared plus C3 squared times B2 A3 all squared. And that's it. And then in this case, we'll get this answer. Call this, we'll get here, we'll get the probability of B2 rho perp prime, which is this expression, okay? Plus, now we're going to get these cross terms are going to give us a contribution to the Born rule. And in particular, we're going to get B2, A2. We're going to get C2, C3 bar, B2, A2 times A3, B2, plus C2 bar, C3. And then we just swap these guys. And presumably, these are going to be complex conjugates of each other. So we know that it's real. And so the point is now we know what these coefficients are because we define B to be this linear combination. So this overlap is 1 over square root of 2. So this is 1 over square root of 2. This is 1 over square root of 2. This one, so it's all halves. So this is equal to the probability in the degenerate observable case plus twice the real part over 2 of C2 bar C3. Okay, so these cancel. So then, as long as the quantum state, now here, no, here's what's cool, right? So, oh, wait a minute, let me not go too fast. What this should show us is that if the initial quantum state was coherent, we didn't write a general expression. But you can see how the point is, as long as the quantum state has support in the subspace on both states 2 and 3, this will be a non-zero thing. And so, or at least there exists a class of quantum states for which you get a non-zero contribution to the probability you expect if you just had a degenerate observable. So the non-degenerate observable leads to different, so the point is we have different experimental predictions. Under a subsequent measurement of a non-commuting observable. Okay, sorry, that was a little bit disorganized because it was off the top of my head, but please let me know if that, does that convince you? Not convince you, but show you how you would do it. Now the trick, now the assumption that was built into this is that, well, how do you know that the second measurement is actually measuring B, right? I mean, there's kind of this infinite regress of how do you use one untrusted device to test another untrusted device? And that's actually a phenomenally interesting and deep question, which my research is focused on. So, you know, my research is divided between quantum computing and quantum foundations, and especially the interplay between them, understanding the power of quantum computing from quantum foundations. But the kind of bread and butter research I do is helping experimentalists find ways with they build noisy systems, noisy state preparation procedures, noisy gates for their quantum computer, and noisy measurements. Of course, they're not intentionally noisy, but they're inevitably noisy. They're imperfect. So how do you kind of bootstrap your way to understanding what your gates are doing and how good your gates are in your quantum computer when you can't trust each gate, you can't trust your measurement procedures, and you can't trust your state preparation? So there's a really interesting field, a really interesting set of questions to look at how to systematically kind of build up your confidence that you believe you know what your system is doing by using the untrusted device, the untrusted gates, and so on to test themselves. And that's something that I'm very active in, and so it's interesting to me. But essentially, what you need is multiple components that are non-commuting, and to do a series of experiments to slowly build up essentially a set of labels for describing those experiments, and then you check that those labels are associated with operators which satisfy the right commutation relationships. So that's part of the idea behind that research program. Okay, so let me just make sure we're tied in here. So we looked at the update rule. We looked at what Luder's rule was, how it was different for degenerate versus non-degenerate measurements, and how to check that indeed you do have a non-degenerate versus a degenerate measurement. And the next thing I wanted to do, which is closely related to this, is actually show you how these update rules are really not that surprising. I mean, there's a whole lot of journal pages have been spent trying to understand the collapse of the wave function and the quantum state update rule. And I'll try and clarify for you why I don't think those are very good questions, because there's a very natural explanation of the update rule, both operationally, which I'll show you, and conceptually in terms of classical mechanics. Classical mechanics also has an update rule, which is identical to the quantum mechanical one. So if you understand it classically, then you're on your way to understanding that the update rule itself is not really a quantum mechanical phenomena and not part. I mean, there are paradoxes and deep philosophical issues in quantum theory, but the update rule is not one of them. So that I'll convince you of in the next lecture. So thanks for your attention and questions. And how about we take a 30-minute break and we'll start the next lecture. Thank you.